Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. After a trip to Vietnam, food writer Suzanne Pfefferly was so inspired by her visit that she quickly immersed herself in her hometown's distinctive Vietnamese community. Suzanne shares what she discovered while filming her first ever video documentary, Vietnamese Cuisine in New Orleans. And speaking of discoveries, food historian and scholar Ryan Fertel uncovered the mystery of who actually authored the original Times-Picayune cookbook, which he'll reveal on today's show. And then I'll introduce you to Baton Rouge native Adam Seeger, one of the world's most influential bar chefs and creator of the new spirit, Hum. Get ready for another delicious serving of this week's Louisiana Eats. You can find Suzanne Pfefferly's food writing in Where Yat magazine and other Louisiana publications. But now, Suzanne is adding the title of documentary producer to her resume with the October 14th debut of Vietnamese Cuisine in New Orleans. Suzanne, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, what's the genesis of your documentary? How did this all happen?
It all began about 2 years ago when I went to Vietnam, and I actually took a cooking class when I was over there and prepared basic dishes like spring rolls, charbroiled pork. And so that was my main introduction to Vietnamese cuisine. And so when I came back, I was kind of hooked on the cuisine. I started trying different restaurants and doing a little bit of research about the Vietnamese community out in New Orleans East. And I realized that they had these urban farms, these gardens, and they have Asian markets, and that there's so much more to the cuisine that many people know. And so I wrote an article for Where Yat magazine about Vietnamese cuisine and interviewed Father Vien and John Besh, and we talked about the urban farms and how John buys some of his ingredients from those farms. And that was sort of the basis of the film. And so I met Lenny Delbert, who does filming for WIS, and we talked about the article and decided to collaborate on a film together. And it's kind of grew from there.
As a hometown New Orleans girl, why Vietnam? What took you there in the first place?
I like traveling places where the culture is very different than my own, I guess. I had been to India and Egypt before that. Vietnam, I was fascinated with partially because of the history. I studied the Vietnam War in school and things like that. And it also just struck me as just such a beautiful country, geography-wise. And the culture was so fascinating to me. I wanted to learn more about it. When I went over there, it was everything. It was more than I imagined. It was incredible. It was beautiful. The people were so nice. And the food was amazing. And there's so much to it. There's the bustling city of Saigon, and there's the villages and the countryside and a more laid-back Vietnam than I knew.
How were you welcomed by the Vietnamese during your travels?
I found the Vietnamese to be very warm and friendly. And going over there, I was a little bit apprehensive about what their reaction would be to me as an American, and I wasn't sure what to expect. I didn't know anyone who had been to Vietnam or, you know, could give me that sort of information, but what I found is that they were very warm, welcoming. They wanted to hear a little bit about me and my story and what life was like in America. I wanted to hear about them. And there was a nice cultural exchange between me and the other person. And I never experienced that animosity or bitterness that I thought that I may encounter.
Had you studied filmmaking in college?
I did not. I started at Loyola as a journalism major, but I really thought about going into print journalism, and that's sort of where my background is. I did take a few film classes, but I had never studied you know, how to make a documentary or produce a film or anything like that. This was all sort of trial by fire. I learned as I went along, and Lenny Delbert's amazing, and so he gave me some guidance and coaching. I met with Peggy Scott Laborde a few times when I first worked on this and basically said, I don't really know where to start or where I'm going with this. I don't know how to put together all the information because it's so sprawling. There's so much information. And it's not like an article where I take a linear approach. It's you can take different angles, rearrange the information. And so that was a little bit overwhelming at first, but I had great coaches and guidance. So it worked out.
So who did you interview? How long did this process take?
It has taken about 11 months, a little over, almost a year. Let's see. I interviewed at this point, I guess, about 20 people. We went to different festivals, but some of the people include, we wanted to get, you know, film food critics and also chefs. We interviewed John Besh, Justin Devilliers of La Petite Grocery, Brian Landry, who just opened Born.
Brian did kind of a cool cooking demo for you, huh?
He did. So did John Besh and Justin, and that's in there. They put Vietnamese twists on traditional, you know, New Orleans type dishes. John Besh did a shrimp creole with a Vietnamese twist. Justin had something called a tuna tartare, and he used Louisiana satsumas and Vietnamese herbs and spices. So that was interesting. And then, of course, we go to the traditional Vietnamese places like Tan Dinh, Nine Roses, and see a more authentic version of the food and how it's prepared in those restaurants.
Aside from chefs, who else did you interview?
I interviewed, let's see, Father Vien, who was the former pastor over at Mary Queen of Vietnam in New Orleans East. And he was very instrumental in helping the Vietnamese community come back after Katrina and really drawing attention to that community and reminding everyone that they're there and thriving and just a very remarkable group of people. But so I spoke to him a lot about family traditions and also about how Catholicism plays such a big role in their community. And that's one of the reasons why they are so strong and resilient, because they have that strong faith in God. And that's sort of something that brings them together.
It's fascinating the way some of the Vietnamese and New Orleanians share that deep Catholic tradition, isn't it?
I agree. I am a Catholic. I grew up going to church every Sunday. And so to see that in their community and to see how strong their belief is in God resonated with me very well. And Holy Rosary also has a group, an order of Vietnamese nuns that pray every day. They're there at 6 a.m. praying, and they'll go back in the evening. And that's amazing to me and inspiring.
What were the differences that you saw in the food in Louisiana versus the food in Vietnam?
I think one of the most glaring differences to me, especially when I went over there, is that they don't use spices necessarily to add flavor to their dishes. They use a lot of fresh herbs and things like that. And a bowl of pho was the first dish that I had over there. I arrived late at night and I had pho for breakfast. So
now, explain for those who might not know, what is pho?
Pho is essentially like a noodle soup. You can add chicken, beef, different types of meat, pork. But it's this flavorful broth with vermicelli noodles. And you add different herbs like basil, mint, you know, things like that. Sriracha sauce, however you want to flavor it or spice it. But it's very healthy. Not a whole lot of oil in there. And it's just zesty, I guess would be a good way to describe it.
The lifestyle of the people. Did you see contrasts in the lifestyle in here in New Orleans as opposed to in their homeland, Vietnam?
Not necessarily. I saw a lot of similarities, actually. When I went to Vietnam, I stayed in what's called guest houses. And it's not a hotel. It's a little house. It's a little hotel almost, but it's owned by a family. And so you meet the family. Sometimes they'll have dinner with you. And so I was able to see what Vietnamese life is like firsthand. And coming back here, meeting with members of the Vietnamese community, I had dinner with a couple of families and saw that those mealtime traditions and family traditions have remained very much intact. And they're very similar to traditions of a typical New Orleans family. At mealtimes, you'll have the whole family sitting around the table, sharing dishes, talking about the day, praying before meals. there's similarities. I think the contrasts lie in the type of food and the way it's served. There's different dishes and that sort of thing.
But they're big on lots of courses, too.
Yes. There will be rice, of course, but they'll have like a pork dish, like caramelized pork, fish, salad, like bok choy salad that's steamed, and I'll have shrimp added to the bok choy. Different things like that. So there's several varieties of options on the table. And you'll have a soup. So you'll have like the soup and salad. Then you'll move on to the main courses that are already there. And usually by the time you're finished, you're too full for dessert. But there's always fruit, fresh fruit available. And so there's so much food, but it's healthy.
Suzanne, did you find any lingering effects from the Vietnamese War, either over there or here?
I did more so over there than over here. You know, when I met with people over here, I did hear about their stories about how they came here and how it's still difficult for them to adjust to life because they still miss Vietnam. New Orleans is so different from Vietnam. Of course, you know, Saigon is bustling, but it's not the same. In Vietnam, I did notice lingering effects, and that was very difficult for me. I did study the Vietnam War in school, and that was one thing that sort of became my interest because I wanted to see it from their perspective and learn more about it from the Vietnamese perspective because I knew that there are two sides of the stories. It was a war that's debated, you know, why we're there, why it began. And so when I went over there, one of the first things I did when I was in Saigon was go to the museum, which basically shows a history of the war. And to see the photographs and to see those type of things, the artifacts, was very upsetting. But aside from that, I saw people who were still affected by Agent Orange and had disabilities. And so that was difficult. But the people didn't harbor any animosity or bitterness towards me as an American. I didn't experience any of that. They were incredibly warm, wanted to hear my story. I wanted to hear their story. And that was humbling. I think if there was a word I could find to describe all this, it'd be humbling.
Well, Suzanne, we've always, well, at least since the fall of Saigon, had Vietnamese eateries on the West Bank and out in the East. But why do you think that we are suddenly finding this big proliferation of Vietnamese cafes everywhere?
I've wondered about that as well, but I think the food's becoming more accessible. They have new restaurants in Uptown. They have, you know, Dosan's in Mid-City, which has been there for a while. But it's more available. People are seeing more of it. You don't have to go to the West Bank or New Orleans East. But I think another factor is that it's so healthy. Most of the dishes, for the most part, I mean, there's certainly things on the menu that aren't as healthy as others, but a bowl of pho or spring rolls, that's it's fresh. There's very little oil. There's not a whole lot of emphasis on sauces and things like that. And so you can eat a big meal and still eat healthily, not feel like you overdid it.
How can Louisiana Eats listeners see or learn more about your documentary?
They can visit the WIS website, which is WIS.org, and there is a section devoted to the film, which lists everyone in the film, and then also it will be updated with additional air times and information about purchasing DVDs and that sort of thing.
Oh, that's great. And so when will it air?
It airs on October 14th at 7 p.m. And then it'll re-air on October 20th at 8 p.m.
Well, that's very exciting. So, I can't wait to see the finished product. And what comes next?
I'm going to Cuba. So I hope to do something, a project based on Cuba. So that's the next.
That's pretty exciting. So, well, thank you so much
for
coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
Suzanne Pfefferle, food writer and producer of the new documentary, Vietnamese Cuisine in New Orleans. When the cool breeze of autumn begins to blow across Louisiana, it's finally time to turn the oven on again. Traditional daube is a stew that originated in Provence, where inexpensive cuts of meat were combined with savory ingredients in an earthenware pot called a daubière. A thick dough topping thoroughly sealed the pot, trapping most of the liquid inside and tenderizing the toughest meat. Often the daubières would be allowed to cook all day in the oven of the local village baker, giving housewives time to do laundry and other such tasks. My French cooking teacher, Madeleine Kamen, developed a modern method of accomplishing the same tenderizing technique without using the dough topping. Assemble your favorite stew or pot roast as you usually do. Then take two pieces of aluminum foil and place them one at a time crosswise over the meat and liquid. Mold the aluminum to the side of the pot, right down over the stew or roast, and crimp it closed securely around the rim. Cover the pot with its lid and place in a very low oven, set somewhere between 225 and 300 degrees, depending on how long you can let it bake. In 2 to 3 hours, the tight seal of the aluminum will force the cooking liquid between the fibers of the meat, rendering it fork tender. You'll love the results. For a copy of my beef dough recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website, LouisianaEats at WWNO.org, where you can also easily email us your culinary queries. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. After a short break, dynamic bar chef Adam Seeger joins us for a trip from the farm to the glass. Stay tuned.
You know what we're going to do? Let the bones on live. Let the bones on live. Let the men live. Let the bones on live.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, name the reptile that Louisiana hunters head to the swamps to bag during the short September hunting season, is the alligator. After many years on the federal endangered species list, in 1981, an official alligator season was reinstated in Louisiana. But for the record, by law, restaurants can only serve farmed alligator. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, since I've been living in Louisiana, it's become my family's expectation to see a bag full of alligator every time I come home. For me, alligator's a staple at family gatherings and a must-have around the holidays. And judging by our inbox, I'm not the only one. So congratulations to gator lover Sarah Clifford of New Orleans for winning this week's prize, and thanks to everyone who participated.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the distinctly local ingredient with an absinthe taste that is a vital element of the Sazerac cocktail? Here's the hint. It's also an integral ingredient in Oysters Rockefeller. Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, This week's question is, what is the distinctly local ingredient with an absinthe taste that is a vital element of the Sazerac cocktail? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Adam Seeger is one of the most esteemed bar chefs in the world. Unlike other mixologists, Adam is a certified culinary professional and a master sommelier. Adam's visionary work behind the bar has made him a leader in the farm-to-bar movement, where he promotes his philosophy, if it grows together, it goes together. I recently spoke with Adam during one of his frequent trips to his South Louisiana home.
Well, my dad is an Episcopal priest, and so growing up in South Louisiana, Episcopalians definitely know their way around eating and drinking, and that was really where I fell in love with hospitality and with food and cooking, and started gardening as a young kid and was around a lot of entertainment.
You know, I think farm-to-table is a lot more familiar to people than farm-to-glass. Talk to us about that movement.
Well, it's really exciting because if you see what's going on in the mixology world, so much of it is following what has happened with food trends. And certainly a few years ago, farm-to-table was pretty new, but now a restaurant who isn't connecting with a local farmers and seasonal really isn't in the game. So the concept, whether you call it farm-to-bar or garden-to-glass, is really to connect your cocktails seasonally. Because as the seasons change, not only the weather is different and you have different desires of what is going to be refreshing in the summer and what is going to be warm and comforting in the wintertime, you also have the emergence of more herbs and fresh fruits in your cocktails. And to be able to connect that with the local farms, just like a chef does, is really kind of the next evolution of the cocktail.
And where did your interest in this begin?
This really began from just a culture of food, to grow up in South Louisiana and then to work in Europe and then work for Rick Tremano at True and Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. Kind of took all that of really being immersed with food culture and also loving the garden since I was a kid. So having that real connection and appreciation for something that went from seed all the way to something you could enjoy. So the next logical progression was to pull this into cocktails. It really came to fruition at Nacional 27 when our chef Randy Zweiban and I used to go to the Green City Market together. And he would be shopping for the restaurant for his market menu, and I would shop for our market cocktails.
And when was that? Place that in a time.
This would have been in 2003. So really kind of back before all this was really on the radar, even with kind of the cocktail movement as we know it now. And where that evolved was to then start growing my own herbs. When I worked in Strasbourg in Alsace, one of the things that really impressed me there was we grew our own herbs in a window box in the kitchen and picked the herbs live off the plants to garnish the dishes. So I wanted to have that same intensity of freshness, similar to the herb garden, even at the French Laundry. And so we started to grow. What we first had was a mojito garden with seven different kinds of mint. And from there, the next summer, we started to evolve into lavender and rosemary and lemongrass and more savory herbs, and then figured out a way to keep those alive in the wintertime with sort of an indoor greenhouse, if you will. And then that evolved into meeting Bob and Jenny Barchart, who are the farmers from Harvest Moon Farms in Viroqua, Wisconsin, really kind of the hotbed of organic and biodynamic farming in the Midwest. Well, they went to the point of giving me a tennis court-sized plot on their farm that was my farm bar. And I went up to the farm 2 to 3 times a month, really from seed and the greenhouse to putting the first plants in, and then would go in and be part of that process through the entire summer. And then all the produce, the melons and the heirloom tomatoes and the ground cherries from that plot are what we used at the restaurant that summer.
Oh, that's delicious.
And it was just, it was amazing to be able to make someone a cocktail. I did one, it was a snap pea arena.
What is that?
Well, snap peas are just so fresh. They just scream springtime. And we muddle those with a little bit of lime and some Caprock Organic Gin, a touch of tonic water, and some cracked pepper. And it just kind of makes you feel like you're getting your veggies and your cocktail and springtime all in a glass. But to have that satisfaction of having planted those snap peas and harvested them and had that connection really made it just so natural to share that passion with the customer or the person on the other end receiving it. And I think that really is something that makes food come alive. When you have a connection of where that food came from or where that distillate came from or where the ingredients were, you just have more respect for it. And as a consumer, I think that adds to the whole sensory experience.
Well, let's start off with your delicious invention, Hum.
Well, Hum was the first spirit that I've come out with that is something that started in a mason jar in my kitchen. I've got a number of other, I guess you would call them orphan spirits right now that don't have homes and bottles yet, but Hum was the first one. And the inspiration was Martinique. I wanted to do a rum base. At the time I created it, I was the general manager of Nacional 27 in Chicago. It was the first Pan-Latin restaurant in the city. And because I came from a wine background, I went with the old wine geek mantra of what grows together goes together. And rums in Martinique, I think, are some of the finest in the world. They're estate rums. They're controlled by the French government, just like the wines of Champagne and France and Burgundy. And so the name is actually the Caribbean spelling of rum. We dropped the R to come up with Hum. And to give it a sense of place, all the botanicals you would typically see in the islands. Hibiscus for color, ginger for that spicy base note, cardamom, which they use in their curries for really beautiful, exotic, hedonistic top note. And a little kaffir lime, which I can't take credit for the kaffir lime. That's Francesco Lafranconi, my mentor, had that suggestion after he tasted the original Hum pre-kaffir lime. And that just pulled it really all together.
Where can people find Hum?
In Louisiana, you can find it here at Vieux Carré Liquors here in New Orleans. We're distributed by International Wine and Spirits, who has all the great Belgian beers and craft spirits. So just ask your favorite spirit store and tell them International's got it, and I'm sure they'll get you taken care of.
I bet you they can find it in Baton Rouge, too.
Oh, absolutely. My parents are living in
Baton Rouge. Are they selling it out the back door? What are they doing?
Well, my parents are Episcopalian Hum evangelists now, so they are definitely hitting the streets of Baton Rouge and making sure that it's stocked around, so definitely ask for it.
Well, that's fantastic. One of the things that you are also very well known for is your work in bitters. And as a matter of fact, there was a contest, and you won, and they named a bitters for you.
This was at Tales of the Cocktail 3 years ago, and it was True Organic Spirits out of Los Angeles, one of the kind of leaders with craft organic spirits, and they did a barmaid bitters competition. So mixologists from around the country who had been making bitters sent their samples in, and the finalists got to compete here at Tales. And I was just beyond thrilled to be awarded the herbal category. And so the contest prize was they would create your bitters and then sell them nationally. So it's a Swedish herb bitters called Barkeep. And it's kind of akin to very, very herbal, kind of like being slapped with herbs inside of an English herb garden.
There is such a big bitters happening going on, really an explosion. Talk about that.
Well, bitters are just incredible, and it's so exciting to see. Dale DeGroff right now has just come out with an absolutely stunning bitters that he's launching here at Tales right now. There's the gentleman from Bittercube who are just up the road from us in Milwaukee. There are the Bitter Truth gentlemen in Germany who have really set the bar, I think, from the quality standpoint. And now more and more bitters coming out. Bitters are really kind of the spice cabinet for a mixologist, and there's such an incredible way to take these things that are being crafted from behind the bar and now come into people's homes and other bars and just have that little extra element to take a cocktail to the next level of complexity.
And it's so interesting to me that people can even experiment with making their own bitters at home, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. And the best way, I think, is start with doing your own infusions. And if you have an infusion that goes a little bit too long, then just leave it a couple more weeks, and you actually are kind of on your way to creating some bitters. I had actually been making a blood orange cello, and I had a big mason jar of it and some beautiful cachaça, and it got tucked away for about a year and a half, not by design, and pulled them out, and it was the most gorgeous blood orange bitters base. Because it had really, really soaked in not only all the flavor and aroma, but that bitterness, which gives you the back palate complexity.
It sounds to me like you have a bit of a mad scientist lab at home.
Quite a bit. When I started making bitters, my sort of benchmark was Peychaud's, of course, from here from New Orleans, and Angostura. And I wanted to have something with that level of complexity, but really have it be my own. So those were my benchmark, and I got a lot of advice from Gary Regan, because when he first started making his orange bitters, he went through a number of batches that got kind of strange until he came up with batch number 6, which really nailed it. And he said, you've got to go and start stomping around apothecaries. So there's a place called Mertz Apothecary in Chicago. It's been around since the 1800s, the same family. And they really were just absolutely amazing, because I spent a number of afternoons there with the owner, and he opened up his library and was able to look up all these botanicals. And as I researched more and more, the connection between health and pharmacies and herbal medicine and bitters is just so seamless. And it turns out that almost every item that you put in bitters has some sort of medicinal purpose. And when I dug deeper, I found that 80% of the world's population gets their medicine from botanicals, from nature. Only 20% are going to a Walgreens or a drugstore.com. So it's really going back to that old European way of Mother Nature is providing everything you need, from digestion and your joints and your eyesight and whatnot. And to be able to pull that into a delicious cocktail and kind of have a double enjoyment from it and benefit, it's really fantastic.
A delicious cocktail is always good medicine, isn't it?
It is.
I really want to thank you so much for taking time out from your crazy busy schedule here to sit down and talk with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Poppy, and such fun to be down here and clink glasses with you and be back in my home state.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Seeger, pioneer of the farm-to-glass cocktail movement. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero played a big role in creating one of Louisiana's earliest new wave of farmers markets. 16 years ago, our culinary heritage hero was a professor of landscape architecture at Louisiana State University when a student came to her with an idea.
Well, I was just a teacher, and one of my brilliant students said, "There's a man selling mustard greens on the side of the road in his neighborhood. Maybe we need a market in this community." And I said, "Well, that'd be great, but I don't know how to do it." He said, "Well, I do, if you can help me get the people together." And I knew the community, he knew the farmers, and there it was.
The impact that the Red Stick Farmers Market has had on local farmers has been profound.
If you look at statistics, where there used to be, let's just say, 400 family farms, maybe there's now 40. And these people are up against all kinds of market forces that make it a struggle to keep their land and to make it economically viable. If they didn't have an outlet like ours, they wouldn't be able to make it. Most of these people had second jobs when they started coming here, and they've been able, because of our access to shoppers, they've been able to get rid of that second job and make a go of it, farming full time. So that's a hard thing to communicate to people who come here once a week or twice a week and make friends with the farmer, but, you know, they're also interested in what they're going to cook for dinner tonight.
As the Red Stick Farmers Market prepares to celebrate a very sweet 16th anniversary serving the Baton Rouge community, we've chosen Susan Turner as this week's Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. I'm Poppy Tooker, and the Baton Rouge Red Stick Market is a great place to find Louisiana eats. Don't go anywhere. When we come back, food historian and scholar Ryan Fertel solves the mystery of who really wrote the original Times-Picayune cookbook. Mm-hmm.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Jill Benson, editor of Louisiana Kitchen Magazine, specializes in the most unusual and out-of-the-way destinations for the food in our delectable state. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Jill is here with the latest scoop. Jill, what are you serving us today?
Well, Poppy, on a recent drive from Monroe to the Alexandria Pineville area, pulled off to the side of the road when I saw a restaurant look like a big red barn, and indeed it was called The Barn, and it's in Columbia.
Where is Columbia?
Well, Columbia, as I said, is between Monroe and Alexandria Pineville, which is located towards the eastern central Louisiana. And I went ahead and checked the census statistics on Columbia, and as of the 2000 census, they had just under 500 people calling Columbia home.
Well, it's no metropolis then.
No, it is no booming metropolis, but there's still a good reason to go there. Susan Poe was born in Columbia, and she moved back to Columbia after having served as a hurricane chaser for insurance companies with her husband. And while they were out chasing hurricanes, she would often take temporary employment as a baker. So she has baking skills, wanted to go home to Columbia, bought a restaurant from a lady who was ready to retire. And in October of 2011, she opened The Barn, and she just started cooking the food that she knows. It's simple home cooking, stewed okra, stewed chickens, fried catfish, fried chicken, with a particular emphasis on fresh vegetables, often stewed. And people started showing up in droves. They just cannot get enough of what she's cooking. So they'd forgotten how to eat this way. They'd become so enamored of frozen dinners and quick grab-and-go meals that they no longer appreciated home cooking. She had one lady come out to help her on her farm. The lady was astonished to discover that new potatoes came out of the ground. And Susan Poe knew there was a problem when that happened. So in addition to serving all this wonderful, fresh, wholesome food at her restaurant, she's been trying to re-educate the people of her hometown about how to eat fresh, healthful, delicious food. And she's hired a legion of ladies who are all accomplished home cooks to work for her. And they make beautiful, towering pies and cakes and muffins. And they can't keep the shelves in the restaurant stocked with jams and jellies and other condiments for people to take home and start to use with what they're cooking in their homes. And people have been inspired to step up what they're serving at home as well.
Do they serve lunch and dinner?
Well, she serves breakfast and lunch, and she will stay open until the food runs out. So some people stop by in the evening to try to buy up whatever's left from earlier in the day. And if she has something, she'll send it home with them. If she has enough to seat around to people, she will do that. But the restaurant is open until there's nothing left. And then on Friday and Saturday evenings, she'll often open for people to come in just with their guitars or banjos and have impromptu jam sessions.
What kind of music can you expect to hear there?
Well, as Susan was telling me, it's usually either gospel or bluegrass music. And people typically show up often on Friday or Saturday nights, and they bring their guitars or fiddles or banjos or just whatever other instruments. And they sit around the dining room, and as she says, they just have a good jam session.
That's the secret of the roving reporter, finding us those out-of-the-way places to visit when we're out there on the Louisiana highway.
Thanks, Poppy. I'll be roving right along now.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Jill Benson. If you are a lover of food history, especially of the Creole variety, there's a very good chance that at least one of the Times-Picayune Creole cookbooks is on your shelf. Maybe it was your mother's or your grandmother's, or maybe it's the great sesquicentennial edition published in 1987 with revisions by food writer Marcel Bienvenu. None of the editions are credited with an actual author, but food historian and scholar Ryan Fertel has made it his business to solve that mystery. Ryan, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
I'm so happy to be here.
Now, let's begin by placing this early Creole cookbook in context. How important was it at the time, and how do you think it's held up culinarily?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I think the Picayune Creole cookbook, like the Picayune newspaper itself, is a cultural artifact from New Orleans that people have actually consumed, like gumbo, for the lifetime of it. People love the newspaper. People love that cookbook and have from the very beginning.
So why was it written in the first place?
Well, it could be several reasons. Around the turn of the century, around 1900, you have a lot of compendium cookbooks come out. You have the Boston Cooking School cookbook. This is just another one of those compendiums. So the Picayune Creole cookbook, it's first released in 1900. Commonly thought that the first edition is 1901. That's just a mistake that's been perpetuated for decades and decades. Servants, especially down south, were disappearing. Of course, elite households continued to have cooks, servants on staff, but many households lost that.
Ryan, I know that you own a copy of each of the editions. Why did the amassing of this particular collection matter to you?
It was a bit of post-Katrina stress and obsessive compulsion collecting. You know, I was exiled up in New York. I was going to graduate school up in New York. I left after the storm, and I was interested in the city's culinary history. I started collecting every single old cookbook I could lay my hands on.
Now that you've got all these copies, and I imagine that you have examined them pretty obsessively also, side by side. So how did the book change over time?
First, the books get bigger over time, right? So there's more recipes. They get larger. Second, I think more interesting is the credit that is given by the editors, the anonymous editors of the cookbook. Credit is given to different groups of people over the 20th century. So, for instance, between that first edition in 1900 and the fourth edition in 1910, credit is given to both African-American cooks and white cooks in the city, kind of historical credit. Now, that changes in the fifth edition in 1916 when credit is given to professional white male chefs from France, from other parts of Europe.
Now, that's just bizarre. Why do you think that was going on?
Well, the restaurant culture in New Orleans is changing dramatically in that time. New Orleans is being re-touristed. We have the train coming into the city. A bit later, we have the advent of the car. New Orleans becomes a popular tourist destination, not for the first time in its history. Restaurants are popular. Restaurants like Antoine's, Begay's closes around that time, but they're on the tourist trail.
Now, no single author's name was ever attributed with this work. I'd like you to talk a little bit about your research to discover who was ultimately responsible for this great, famous tome.
I basically did a search of the Picayune's archives, old issues, and I found the author of the cookbook, not in an article, but in an obituary, not her own obituary, but the obituary of her brother.
Who was this mystery woman?
Oh, this mystery
You're
woman.
You're killing me.
Her name was Mary Louise Point. She was a French Creole, grew up in a elite household in the Garden District. She was a writer in the 1880s, 1890s, early 20th century.
Who was she writing for?
She was a journalist for the Picayune, and she also wrote for Catholic magazines and publications. She was a hearty Catholic.
And spell her last name for us.
Oh, P-O-I-N-T-S, points.
Ah, okay. But it was probably Point.
Point.
Is since we're here in New Orleans. Well, who was Eliza Nicholson?
She was the famous editor that took over the Picayune in the late 19th century. She is credited with being the first woman who was the owner of a major daily newspaper, an urban daily. She totally revolutionized that paper in the 1880s. She, I say, feminized it. She added a cooking section. She hired women journalists for the first time. She really transformed that paper. And although the cookbook came out after she had passed, I think that cookbook, those recipes, have a lot to do with her influence.
Well, let's go back to this author. I want you to clearly illustrate for me and trace back how you come to the conclusion that it was Miss Point who was responsible for this enormous work.
Right. So Mary Louise is mentioned in her brother's obituary. He was a doctor. He died in April 1946. And embedded in that obituary, for really no reason at all, it says he was the brother of Mary Louise, who had previously passed. Mary Louise was, quote, the author of the original Times-Picayune Creole cookbook.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a little piece of information in an obituary, and it helped me find the author of this cookbook, something people have been looking forever. But I think what it shows is when we lose print, when we lose a daily publication, and of course I'm speaking to what's happening with the Picayune now, we lose all types of information that is embedded in places that we wouldn't normally look or recognize as news. So I'm a historian. I use advertisements all the time. I use obituaries. Letters to the editor are immensely important.
Why do you think that Mary Louise's place in history has yet to be officially recognized in some way?
Well, one, she was a woman. Women weren't given credit, you know, all that much. You did have a group of female writers in New Orleans, Grace King, Kate Chopin.
Dorothy Dix,
who were finding some fame, both locally and nationally. So cookbooks, although they weren't a new invention, didn't necessarily sell. It wasn't a way to build a career as a writer. There were no food scholars. There were no food writers back then. So most likely, Mary Louise didn't want to put her name on it. Also, she probably had a crew of people, a circle of editors for the Picayune help her on this.
Well, I want to thank you for revealing the answers to this great mystery and visiting with us on Louisiana Eats. Will you please come back?
I will, I promise.
Writer, scholar, and food historian, Ryan Fertel. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we travel along with Kristen LaJeunesse as she tours the U.S. in search of vegan food.
It's a lot of work. I'm not earning any money right now, and I'm solely doing this not only for self-exploration, but to also, like I said earlier, spread the vegan message. And it's something that I'm really, really passionate about. So it's interesting to me that the only pushback have been just from a few vegans within the community itself.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh, and to our editors, Zoe Sullivan and Lane Kaplan-Levinson. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time.
Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.